From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time my guest was here, she was talking about a show that was on Peacock. It's now on Netflix. Interestingly enough, it's the same show. We're thrilled to have back here on the show. Sitting across from me for once is one of the stars of that show, Girls Five Ever, Paula Pell. Thank
Hello.
You so much for being here. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
I have to tell you, I love what Gloria is doing on the show so much this season because she's so liberated.
Oh, God. My wife writes for it also, and she calls it a trampage. I'm on a trampage.
Or a hospice.
I'm hospice, but don't write it down because it looks like hospice. No, she's really sowing her oats because she's finally got her ex-wife back, played by my wife in real life. And, you know, she finally got her back after all this, the last two seasons. And then now she's like, oh, wait a minute. You're the only one I've ever been with. I just need a little while. Let me just go across the country on a janky tour and try to be with the 178 types of women.
There is this thing that you do that I've come to see you do as an actor, where you can express desperation and ambition simultaneously.
Oh, that's I like that. Thank you.
She's ambitious both to fulfill this thirst that
yes.
she has, but also to be heard.
Yeah.
And we talked about when you last year, so often you write characters who want to be heard. But in the first episode of this new season, when she sings that sort of folk song, I'm not sure how genre-wise to describe it.
I know. Is it Game of Thrones? Is it like, I don't quite understand the genre of that song, but I love it so much. There's a sorcerer and there's so many references, but then I'm playing it kind of like an Indigo Girls song. It's a real fantastically strange song I'm singing to this woman I just had a one night stand with, and I want desperately to stay and, you know, be my dog's dad or mom. Then I start just singing this folk song.
There's so much going on. The show feels so much denser
yes.
than it has before. And I think it's also because it's so specific about locale. Each episode in the season is in a specific place. And having been somebody who also worked in Fort Worth for 2 years.
Oh my God.
I can tell you that it captures a kind of need to sort of say, we're not Dallas, we're not Austin, we're not Houston. That's very specific to that place. But that moment you have in that episode is such a powerful piece of acting. I want to ask you about playing that, because you could play it for a laugh. And
yeah.
so often you come close to doing what could be like a sketch turn and you bring it back to something real. But there's so much fire in her as she's singing that song.
Yeah. No, I just love with Gloria that, because it's so art imitating life for me, because I just turned 60 this last year and I'm still showing my boobs on television. I'm the only one that's topless in this season. No, I'm actually busy, has a moment of nudity,
yeah,
but
she has
it is blurred, but, and mine are blurred. What if I said that's not blurred? That's just how they look. No, they are blurred. They're a member of SAG is my bit. That's my last joke on my boobs. I love the show so much because there's a little bit of air, even though it's frantic, it's still got that 30 Rock energy of like that blueprint of Tina's producing of like everything, and Robert Carlock of like boom, 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 Meredith Scardino created
yes,
it.
Yes.
It's just a joke a minute. But it has these moments, which is my favorite thing, hard jokes with heart and like moments of a real humanity in it. It is that desperation is like, in my real life, I'm finally speaking the truth about what I like, what I don't like, what I want, who I am. It's not, you know, I came out pretty late in life, and not just that, but being gay, but just like, just speaking the freaking truth about everything. Like, do you want this? Do you like this? I just would always go through I called it the Midwestern liar. There's Southern liars and there's Midwestern liars. And they're the ladies that, oh, that's so nice. And then they walk away and talk about it, you know?
Or say, are you okay?
Yeah.
That this would need to be heard by saying,
yes.
I'm looking out for you.
Yes. My grandma used to eat soup and then at a diner, and she'd go, oh, is this delicious? I love this soup. Oh, and how I love it. And then we'd walk out and she'd go, I didn't care for that soup. And I really I grew up learning that. And so I love that my character and myself, and really all our characters, were of an age that we're like, we can finally be honest that we love doing this and we didn't get to do it anymore. And now we have a chance to do it and we'll do anything. We'll do anything. We'll fail. And Meredith loves to write underdog. And that's my favorite thing, you know, with all the, my SNL characters are these kind of underdogs that you look at them and you go, oh, God, but God, I hope they get their what they're looking for. I hope they want, you know, and I feel like that energy is something I think a little bit missing in television right now. I feel like we need more TV and movie of like that hard comedy, like really hard comedy with also that inspirational, aspirational human thing of like, yeah, I'm going to get behind. I'm falling in love with this character. And now I want her to get what she wants. I want her to be happy. I want her to find joy. And we all four are written in different ways of finding that. Everyone's realizing they can still dream at this age. And in my real life, that's how I you know, stopped acting when I got to SNL and put that away. And then I am getting to do it in my 60s. And it's just incredible. So fun.
A scant 20 years later, she's finally acting again. Although I got to see her act standing as close as I am to her right now. It's the dream, I guess, is our old friend Paul LaPelle. The new season of Girls 5 Eva is on Netflix. I have all the episodes to drop. You can also hear the show at kcow.com/thetreatment. But it's funny, it's also about two eras. And that era of the 90s you're talking about was the era where women were being supplicants.
Yeah.
We're not saying who they were or what they wanted. And that ambition was there, but it was unfocused. So now that there's a focus to the ambition, I mean, I think that really gives something to play. So we can see when Gloria talks about who she is now, they're the remnants of trying to cast off that person she had been.
Yeah.
Like that hilarious and heartbreaking sex video. I'm not going to say anything more about it, but it's Brechtian that
There's
moment.
There's no sex in it, guys.
There's no people in it on
There's
the camera.
There's no people and no sex. They're playing hide and seek. I won't say who it's with, but I think you'll enjoy it. But it involves two people that definitely don't want to have sex.
But that moment is both hilarious and heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, which is my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing.
Because it's often when the moments are meant to be kind of heartbreaking, there's a sentimentality in the comedy. And I think about this when with your writing. There's a kind of a need to move on. There's like almost a ruthlessness to the momentum of it. So much of the show, especially in this season. I felt the last couple episodes, the second season, were kind of lining things up for this year.
Yes, yes.
But it's all paying off so beautifully. And that episode that we're talking about, they're lost at sea in that episode.
Yeah. We always, I think the beauty of each season is we do get to that place where we get in our own way for sure. But then also just where most people would just give up. There's that moment where we look at each other and go, wait, if we get one little wisp of a chance again, like, you know, even at the end of this season, I don't want to spoil it, but we end up biting off more than we can chew on a commitment of going to be in a very iconic place to perform.
It's a payoff to what happens in the first episode.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, everything is like, let's just try it. Let's just throw everything at it. Then we're screwed for the whole season because we've thrown all our money at doing that chance to do that. And at the end, there's just so many things that tie together that, you know, there's moments in that show where we cry, like we're on set and we look at, we've read what it is. But then when you see that touching moment where there's something is revealed, we'll look at each other and go like, I can't take it. There's so much authentic, like emotion behind it. But then in the next moment, I've got my boobs out and we're doing some hilarious, hilarious scene that's insane, like complete insanity, but still somehow grounded. I don't know how they do it.
Well, I find so fascinating about this season too, is that there's this weird thing where each of these places feels like it's trapped in its own time.
Yeah.
And none of these places feel contemporary, which makes their ambition to pop feel all that much more anxiety provoking to me.
Yes.
And I'm really feeling that in performance terms for each episode with Gloria, that second episode in the season where a dream kind of comes true for her, that it's almost in this weird way, like an O. Henry Christmas story.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I've thought of it so many times when I was in college, I went to University of Tennessee in Knoxville and my best friend was gay and I was gay and we were closeted. You know, he and I would go to these gay bars in like the just most rural parts of Tennessee. And we would look across, because on Sundays, usually gay bars will do a big, big party. And they would have like tea dance where it was just, you know, 3-for-1 drinks, whatever. And dance, you know, dance, drag show. And I just remember very vividly being young and being with him at some gay bar in Tennessee. And I just remember looking out at a sea of people dancing, and they were all gay. And I just looked at them and I was like, where did these people come from in this area? Like, do you travel to this? Or, you know, because it was a massive amount of people that came. It was like destination place to come on Sunday. But I just get so touched in my heart, because I did live a lot of years where it wasn't okay to be who you were. So going through this, it really touched that memory for me of going through places where you can't totally be yourself. And so it was great to have them write me a story where I find my people.
Pockets of the entire country are kind of like that, where people can't be themselves.
Right.
And there's kind of a truth that has to be exposed in every episode this season, which I think makes it unusual and different, distinct from the seasons that have come before.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a lot of uncovering secrets, and getting to the truth is just, it's such an important thing in my own personal life now. And it's really important, I think, in writing these characters to always be showing how they still try to throw their bullshit. And I don't know if I can I say bullshit on here. Bull crap.
That's why we have scissors.
But they, you know, they still, we're always still in life and in television shows as characters. We're still trying to throw our bull crap out there to try to get away from being vulnerable, getting away from, you know, telling people the truth, whatever. We're still doing our shtick. And I love that that's this good tension all the time with the characters of like, we are friends so closely with each other in that show that we turn and go, you're doing this. And then it's like, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. And then you admit it. And that brings that heartbreaking scenes where you have to really admit this. And that could be applied to so many scenarios on that show. I love it.
And I think the last episode of the second season sort of teed it off, that moment where they're auditioning to go what they think is going to be this big tour that's going to save them. Part of me as a viewer is hoping that they didn't get it just because they can't have their dreams come true.
Right.
But the amount of performance thrown into that song before they don't get it, that's almost a purely dramatic moment in the show that I found to be really powerful.
Yeah, I'm so glad, because I feel it when I'm doing those kind of scenes. And, you know, I'm a writer all these years, and recently I was looking at my desktop on my computer, and there was a script that I had written with my friend, and I was just looking at the iterations of that script and how many, like maybe 2 or 3 years we were rewriting and developing with somebody and, you know, a studio and all this. And just how many times in my life I have gone through this project where I think of all these characters and we think of all this stuff, and then it just never finds its place. It was never purchased. It was never greenlit. It was never. And you kind of go, does that mean I never wrote it? It's like the tree that falls in the forest, you know? And I feel like with us, with this, we love the performing. When we get up there, you see it, you feel it, you look at our characters, and we're just alive. We're lit up. It's like, we're still getting to do it. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it. But we're gonna get our cash together and go do it.
It's the truth. We'll take a break. My guest is Paula Bell. She's one of the stars of Girls 5 Ever Now on Netflix, all 3 seasons. There's more to come. Stay with us. It's the treatment. We're hydrating with my guest, Paula Pell. She's one of the stars of Girls 5 Ever on Netflix. You can all hear this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. You were talking about horror comedy. And one of the things I find so often watching comedy the last 10 years or so is you watch it and you kind of say, oh, that's funny.
Yes.
But you don't laugh.
with a straight face.
This show is very so specifically about delivering laughs.
Yes.
I mean, we were talking about that sort of fulcrum balance of heartbreak and heart laughs. And there's an episode where you and Busy, she's becoming a business person.
Yes.
And her product has a horrible side effect. but you're not playing it as a joke. You're right. playing it as if it were a real problem. Mm-hmm. You call yourself a writer and a singer. I knew you as an actor because, again, I saw you act sitting right in front of me. So I know you as an actor. And I think about you primarily as an actor. And so many of these beats you're playing with your actor's training. And there's got to be so much pleasure you get out playing a scene like that, that, again, you could play in a sketch way, or you could sort of play it in a way that triggers an audience reaction of tears. But you're playing, how do we get you past this? I was fascinated in, yeah. in the watching of that.
I grew up in a funny family. So, you know, my sister, my mother and father are all very funny people, but they sometimes will be funny in a very stealthy way. So we'd be sitting having a serious conversation, and then there would just be, you know, they call it in comedy writing, the blow, the thing at the end that makes the audience in a sitcom just lose their mind laughing. The sitcom Roseanne was the perfect example of, they'd have some serious little conversation with their kids or their marriage or something. And then there'd be just the, I mean, Golden Girls is the ultimate. It's like writing the serious humanity between them. And then there'll be that thing at the end. And I feel like you get a bigger laugh if you've been authentic in the acting. If you're setting up the laugh with a bunch of bull before it, where they're acting very, here it comes, we're all being fakey, you know, we're not really humans, we're just written word on here. I mean, Golden Girls, they would just look at each other and, you know, Rose, I love you. And there'd be that music. And then they'd go, you know, one of your eyes is a little smaller than the other. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, I made that joke up, but like that really is the kind of thing that my family, that we are real with each other. I was just saying this morning, my favorite Golden Girls joke of all time that I wish I would have written is, Dorothy finds that her mother had this giant savings account she didn't even know about. She goes, I've been taking care of you all these years and you have $35,000 in your bank account. She goes, I was saving it when I'm old. She goes, when you're old, you don't even have fingerprints anymore. But it's delivered like two, like a mother and a daughter. It's not delivered like comedy writers sounding like comedy writers. That's my pet peeve, is when I watch a show and I'm hearing a 70-year-old character on there talking like a comedy writer. It's like, that's not a character you're writing. You're not writing it through the filter of that character, of that person. You're writing it to please yourself.
It's the treatment. I guess who I think was looking at me and talking about my physical anomaly is Paula Pell. She's one of the stars of Girls Five over on Netflix. You can hear the show at kcrw.com/the treatment. You mentioned Golden Girls. When you mentioned Roseanne, you were talking about shows with people filled with actors, with experience. I mean, the cast of Roseanne. Look, it's just John Goodman. It's Laurie Metcalf. Yeah. Both of whom I'd seen
Incredible.
On stage. It's, you're talking about Golden Girls. You're talking about four actors who were stage veterans, who were TV veterans,
yeah.
who knew how to play something.
I mean, all in the family. It's like massive acting talent with those people. In drama, if you do great drama, you can do great comedy often because you are...
I don't know. I mean, many
people that can do great drama okay. can't do comedy. But
this.
I think I've seen, as a host, De Niro be ungodly funny on our show. Like, you can get people that can tap into both, you know, but I think when you're watching it, if there's something authentic, it doesn't have to be high drama, but just have authentic characters that you care about when you're watching them. Then when they come up with something coming at each other, it's hilarious. You know, I told Judd Apatow, I worked with Judd a lot in my early years of doing movie stuff, and he gave me so much great experience. And it was at the height of all those movies that were in theaters, you know, that were hard comedies, but they also had like that, as my niece calls it, hard itch. You know, I told him one day, the reason I love your movies is because the friends in them all give each other crap and they're funny people. It's like, why are you wearing that? Why, that looks stupid. But in the movie, so they're not just talking to serve a joke or to serve the story. They're actually interacting each other. And that's real. That's how friends are. You know, Wine Country was based on my actual friends in that movie and I going on a trip to Napa or wherever. And I mean, during that trip, there were a million zingers because we were giving each other stuff. We were laughing with each other, reminiscing. But it was like a soup of funny and authentic at the same time. And I think the show nails that.
It's funny because what we're talking about in this season, I think for me, it took the show two seasons to get to where we are.
Yeah.
So we can feel that. And that's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. In these shows, such as On the Family and Roseanne and Golden Girls, it took a while for them to earn that kind of stuff. Because in the early days of all those shows, it did feel kind of they were writing to payoffs.
Yeah.
I think with Girls Five Ever, it's got there much faster than I thought it would. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that surprised you too.
Yeah, I mean, I think Meredith has always known where she wants to go and when she wants to go with it. She's really...
You're talking about Meredith Scardino,
Meredith Scardino, the creator, just brilliant, brilliant brain. I think she's always been kind of boiling the soup in her brain of how she wants these characters to get at certain places. And it always feels like organic, like the way we're proceeding, and then we'll rise and we'll fall and we'll rise and we'll fall. And that's the fun of it. Instead of just seeing us rise and be famous, there's nothing fun about just watching someone have that unless they're failing with it, you know. But you also want to not always be watching them fail. You want to watch them have little victories. Like this season, there's a big message of the medium time of how about you be really happy with this middle thing you're doing, you know, that's not the biggest brass ring, but and it's not like you're in the garbage can. You're in the middle there somewhere. You're like, I'm with people I love. I am loving what I do, and not judge it because we compare and despair and we say, oh, that, but that person has this. This person has this kind of house. This person, who cares? The big houses, you're only in about three rooms. That's my theory. When you're in a really big house, you're like, have you ever used this toilet? Because I don't think you have.
I think that what you're talking about with the show, and I think what's interesting too for me about Gloria's character is that unlike all the others, because she's had to deny herself for so long, there's been so much of this kind of self-abnegation that we're seeing in this season that all she can do though is see what's about 10 feet in front of
her. Yes, yes.
I mean, the others are consumed about not being able to live with these ambitions. And we've seen that with Renee's character all the time. Mm-hmm. Just everything is constantly slipping through her fingers like sand. I love that for Gloria. It's just whatever she can reach out and grab is what she wants.
Yes. And she's playing catch up. She's playing this desperate catch up of like, I want to set my life up the way I always wanted to, but I just want to make sure it's right so it'll last. I don't want it to fall apart again. I want this all to, you know, all to work. And in my personal life, I remember when I got divorced and I'd been married for, you know, 17 years, I remember thinking, the next person I'm with, I'll never probably have a 30-year anniversary. Like I was doing the math of like, I'm at this age and I'm not going to have these things that you think of like, oh my God, isn't it going to be cool to be married 40 years? Or my parents have been married 60 something years, you know? And you go, wow. And so it's like that catch up. If there's change in the middle of your life and you feel like you're starting over, then it's like, I got to catch up. I got to set this up again so I can restart and really put down some years in being happy. So I feel like my character is very similar to me in that. And I think they've watched me. They all know me so well at that show. And so they've watched me and written a lot of things having to do with my own life, I think, you know, except for the trampage. I never went on a trampage.
Whatever you say. But I guess I would ask you this, because that moment she has in that first episode of this season, at the very beginning, we think, oh, she finally got something she wanted. There's part of us as an audience cheering for her because she finally got this thing and she seems to know how to deal with it. You know, it's just a one-night stand.
Yeah.
It's okay. And I think in that moment, she actually seems to feel like it was okay just to have that. But then she's doing the thing you're talking about. She's suddenly starting to do these story problems in her head. Well,
oh yeah.
What about there being a tomorrow?
Right.
What,
and I tomorrow? Was always like that. I mean, I would have a very quick fling with someone. And then in my journal, I'd write about like how beautiful their eyelashes were. And I could see that on a child. It's like I would really go way too far, way too early because I just was never interested in just something casual. You know, I always wanted that depth. And so doing those scenes where I keep going, it's just no strings. It's just like, no, I don't care. And then I'm like, I wonder what she's doing right now. Wonder how her allergies are. Like you worry about the person. You don't even know them.
But there's this kind of childlike belief in romance that to me
yes.
is what Pop is about. And her allegiance to Pop in that way.
Yes.
All those songs that we hear those pieces of are about wanting these things to happen.
Yes.
And I feel like in those moments with Gloria, she's kind of living out pop songs. And
yes.
I find it to be really profoundly touching.
Yeah, I find it so touching because I do know that feeling of I just want to feel not just safe, but to be with somebody that I deeply know. And now I'm very, very happy with my forever wife. And I know that I've done that. But I am, once again, like of an age that is it makes you kind of go, oh, can I go back a little bit, you know, and redo this a little bit? Not redo it, because I don't believe in that. I think everywhere that you went and what you did brought you to where you are and who you are. I don't believe in like wishing I could go completely back and do it completely differently. But I'd be taller. That's it. I'd just be taller.
It's not all it's cracked up to be. But I have to ask you this, too. Is it hard to watch the show just because there's so much emotionally at stake for her? I mean, it goes in increments. It's only like cubic centimeters.
Yeah,
her.
Yeah.
But there's so much at stake.
Yeah.
That, to me, speaking to the power of your performance, to the honesty, I was going to say sincerity, but that's not the word I mean. Because you're talking about, I think, in effect, a kind of dramatic truth. Gloria is kind of reaching for that in much smaller ways than the other characters are. And I find it to me to be a much more emotionally volatile ground to behold. And I wonder if you can watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I love watching it. And the funny thing with the comedy side of it is that show is so packed with ungodly funny lines that you have to watch it on closed caption because you really watch it and you go, wait, I missed four jokes in that sentence. And then you put it on CC and you see like all four hilarious jokes within that sentence. But the sweet parts of it, because the four of us are nauseatingly in love with each other, when we watch that show, either separate or together, we'll text each other like, oh my God, I just cried. Oh my God, I just cried. Oh my God, I just cried at you, at your little speech. Oh my God, I just busy. I cried at your little song. You know, the song you did. Who am I anyway? You know, who am I? Am I myself or what? I forgot the, I'm bad at remembering the time.
You think she's going to run out of things to burn at a certain point?
Yeah, yeah. But we started the show during the pandemic and we were all so bereft of any, like, we just were so lost, all of us. And for us to come together and be able to take our masks off and be in a room acting together, and we were the only ones could take our masks off. We would breathe each other's air, you know? We just had this, it's like blood sisters, you know? But it was breath. It was like we said, I don't care if we're gonna all give each other the thing. It's like we are going to be the sacred little four good witches, you know?
I guess we're talking Condensation Sisters with my guest, Paula Pell. She's starring in what I hope is not the last season of Girls 5 Eva on Netflix now. I'm glad it's found a new home, and the show is really terrific. And it's great work from you, and you're always welcome here. Come back anytime you want.
Thank you. I just enjoy talking to you so much.
Most of us first came to know her as a writer and occasional bit player on Saturday Night Live, but Paula Pell has shown her skills as an actor and a singer in recent years, both on Peacock and on Netflix, where the series Girls 5 Eva currently resides. She starred in a comedy show for all three of its seasons. Careers that span decades or are just getting started at the Archive. KCRW.com/thetreatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, and I don't sing or act, but I've been around for decades, too. So has The Treatment, and there's more of it ahead. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Edward Zwick, has been around for so long in Hollywood that he's now known as Ed Zwick. His book is Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. It's a pleasure to welcome him back to the show, as I said. And it's funny, the thing I got from the book is so often you made movies, you're attracted to stories about people who have to prove something. Mm. And often the calamitous circumstances, mm-hmm. but something mm-hmm. they have to prove something. And that first thing you did with Marshall's special bulletin, in addition to being an arduous shoot, you both underwent the loss of family members while it was happening.
Yeah. And I think it marked us in some way. I'm not sure we understood that right away, but the idea that there was some crucible that you went through to make a movie. And I think it led us at different times to want to maybe hold an audience's hand over a flame a bit. And I think that sensibility is in a bunch of movies.
Even Special Edition, Special Bulletin, forgive me, is about somebody having to get through and prove that he can do a job under the worst of circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's following, in real time, a newsman reporting on the end of the world, a mm-hmm. Nuclear conflagration, and him having to get through this. Mm-hmm. And that really is holding your hand to the fire.
Yeah, somebody once said that's what directors are always doing, that they're always making movies about themselves, trying to make movies that, you know, if that's Fitzcarraldo, you're trying to, you know, carry a boat over a mountain.
Talk about where the title comes from, because that's one of my favorite anecdotes in the book.
Well, I mean, what I remember is that there was the Preston Sturges expression that says a hit is the thing that you do between flops. And I think that's just something that when I realized that was built into the career, that, you know, you look at anybody's IMDb, you find that there is that inevitable moment in which you just totally step in and you don't know what you're going to do and how you're going to get out. And that it's not a question of if you get knocked down, but when you get knocked down and what do you do when you are down and how do you get out of that? And I had that experience in a very vivid way. I'm so full of myself. Our television show had won best television show. I had done Glory. I was invited everywhere. And I agreed to do this movie that Sydney had sent me called Leaving Normal.
Sydney Pollack,
who was very much, you know, important in my life. And I made that movie, and somewhere along the way, it became very clear to me that it wasn't working. And I didn't have the balls to call the studio and say, we've got a problem, because I was somehow going to make it work.
Because what I got from the book is that you thought that if you just kept to it because you'd done these things,
yes,
you just stayed at it, it would turn around for you.
Right. But that is a certain amount of sense of sort of invulnerability, that you're bulletproof. But in fact, I was not. And once we played the movie, it was clear that it was nice. It was nothing wrong with the movie. It's quite pleasant and good, but good is not good enough. And to compound things, the movie was opening on a Friday, as movies used to open, and I went to the theater on the promenade to see how the audience responded at the end of the 4 o'clock feature before the six. And I went into the theater. It was not many people, and they didn't respond very much. And I said to myself, well, that's just because it's the afternoon. And I walked out to see what the line might have been for the Friday night feature. And there was no line. And then I looked up and down the promenade, and there was nobody. It was just as if there were like, you know, things blowing through the promenade, you know, like tumbleweeds.
Tumbleweeds,
like, what's going on here? And then, of course, I got in my car and I turned on the radio, and it was the night of the LA riots. And it wasn't just that people weren't watching the movies in Los Angeles. They weren't watching the movies in New York or Chicago or anywhere else. And that movie was out of the theaters literally in days. I don't think it played more than a week. And the phone stopped ringing. And I was in movie jail. And that was, you know, a pretty tough pill. But as it turned out, really a really important one, because it wasn't the first time it was going to happen. And when it happened again, I actually understood that it wasn't the end of my life. I understood that you could get back up.
But there's also a story you tell in the book about your wife meeting a producer, an anecdote that further defines hits and flops.
My wife is a very decorous and I think an appropriate person, but she has her moments. And this was a moment in which we found
I've always seen her have her moments.
We were at this very fancy cocktail party, and there was someone there, and she talked about a movie that she had very much liked. I think it was The Official Story.
It is, yes.
And, you know, she was talking, just, you know, praising it. And this voice says, flop. And we turn around, and there's this rather ample man wearing a odd sort of caftan. And she said, "I beg your pardon?" And he said, "Oh, only two kinds of movies, babe, hits and flops." And I think it was the use of the word babe that really got her. And she turned to him and she said, and what do you do? Which, of course, to his ego was shattering because supposedly everyone's supposed to know who he was. And he said, "I'm a producer." And she said, "Oh, well, only two kinds of producers, babe, artists and And, you know, it was that moment when literally the conversation stops and I see that something's, you know, happening here that I hadn't expected. But in fact, that particular producer certainly never offered me a movie over the years.
But I just find myself, because I've known you for so long, because I know what the work's about. Even in that moment, it becomes about sort of laying down this line, or fate is laying down a line for you, and the question is, will you cross it or not? I mean, that's certainly what Legends of the Fall is. I mean, that's the siege. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's so much of the work. I mean, I just told you, last night I happened to catch Upon Sacrifice on TV. And even that, I mean, it's about how far will you push yourself at the point where you're told you can't do this. Mm-hmm. There's a point early on where young Bobby is beaten by a rather supercilious chess instructor who says, he's good, but he's not great. Mm-hmm. I mean, those moments inform so much of your work.
I know there are certain, you know, psychological issues having to do with how I was raised, and I had a depreciating father, you know, and there was certainly this sense of having to overcome this thing, or maybe to overcompensate and to look for, you know, validation outside. But I do know that I would create situations with authority figures, and then I would have to try to either get through them or over them or around them. And it probably found its expression in these movies unconsciously. I don't think I set out to say, oh, I'm going to make a movie about a man who does this.
I'm not saying that was the plan, but at a certain point, I just wonder if you started to see, because in reading about each of the movies in the book, it becomes evident to me in the way that it had not before, I think, that this theme sort of repeats itself. I didn't know as much about your upbringing as I learned from the book. And what starts to happen, too, is at a certain point, you have contemporaries who are authority figures, people you know, who you end up sort of like both embracing and pushing back against. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be really fascinating.
There's something in the tropes of movies having to do with heroes, which is to say, you know, there's the classic, you know, heroic journey in which they go through some, you know, form of great struggle and some event that defines them. But I think that those heroes that I talk about are often confronting internal challenges as well as external challenges.
Is both this need to sort of prove themselves and against this calamitous circumstance? I mean,
or an institution or society in general. Like what is appropriate? What are the cultural norms? Or whether it's a military circumstance in terms of a set of rules? Or I think that's probably true, that they're struggling against something.
Because I think it informs your career as a director, which is in this weird way, this inability to hear the word no.
With one exception, I've never made a movie that I sensed that anybody ever really wanted to make in the beginning. It has always been a struggle every time. And no matter how many have succeeded, and I would say the majority have, everyone has seemed to be a one-off. But also because it's never obvious. I've never really chosen those subjects that seem to conform to a traditional set of circumstances. You know, a man who brings death upon everyone in his family and gets eaten by a bear, a black regiment in the Civil War. You know, I just think there are a lot of those subjects that I think ultimately have classical shape and they've had commercial appeal. But to somebody looking for a more traditional thing that can be marketed or told in a single sentence, or that can be in some way prettified, I think they haven't been obvious. And that's why they've been a struggle.
It's the trigger. My guest who has his radio voice on is Ed Zwick. His book, we know, of course, is a filmmaker, an Oscar-winning filmmaker. He details that in his book, Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions. You can also hear the show at kcow.com/thetreatment. My question is, because I think this has happened to you in a lot of films you made, if you were shocked at the end product, because there's a lot more of you in this than I think you may have thought you were going to put on the page.
Well, I've come to understand that a movie is an organic thing. I think it changes if you're at least present in it. I think that Glory is a very particular example of that. I think that, you know, that movie was imagined as a white savior narrative. It was going to be the Matthew Broderick story, the Robert Gould Shaw,
and lots of movies of that type were being made at that time.
At that time,
even one starring Denzel Washington, as a matter of fact.
That's right. And when I saw what was happening with those guys, with Morgan and with Denzel and with Andre, there was the movie. And I found myself gravitating to the movie and amplifying the movie. And that has happened several times to me, that things, if you allow them, they tell you what they want to be.
But I want to talk to you what I think is the meat of the book, which is the writing, mm-hmm. and having to come to understand things about yourself. Mm-hmm. And also, there are tips throughout the book. And one of my favorites is from the 10 tips with long lunches with Sidney Pollack section. Number 6, the mm-hmm. cutting room floor. There's gold to be found in the outtakes before you set action or after you set cut. Before moving on, try shooting a take when the actors do it without any dialogue. You'll be surprised with what you find. There was great acting long before there were talkies. And after I saw that, went back and watched all the movies and was struck by how many moments are people not just sort of moving or taking a moment. One thing that does is it shows us why they're movie stars.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's servicing that, but it's also doing this thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, you never know necessarily why you're making a movie when you make it. You think you do, but it's not often until long after that occurs to you. And I think that when you look at your own work, I had never looked at my own work in any sort of, you know, careful
way. Did you
have to
do it for this?
I did. It was the first time that I'd ever, it was COVID, and I had nothing else to do. I was becalmed, and I don't do well in that circumstance.
But you were saying that you watched the movies, and what did you come away with in watching? Did you see this thing that, I didn't realize that until just watching it. Oh, this is a guy who understands the difference between an actor and a movie star. And the moments that really sort of coalesce from these moments, we get to see these people, these figures being both. Mm. And silence often shows us that.
That's for sure. There is something in a movie star, whether it's this avidity, this antic inner life, this thing that is happening, and it is finally only revealed in close-up, but not for everyone. Liberty often uses the phrase movie skin, that there's a translucence, that there's a way that you can see internal into things that are happening. And, you know, well, Denzel's a perfect example about this. There's a duality. There's an ability to be in that craft and understanding the camera and where the mark is and all the things that are technical, but to maintain this process, this ferocious inner experience of the character at the same time. And I think that's not often the way. I think that probably most actors, if you were to attach electrodes to their, like a lie detector for respiratory and heart and whatever, and if you say action, that those would all go up. I think with the great actors, they go down. There's an ability to sort of spin inward and allow that inner life and trust that inner process and focus and concentrate on it. And the camera loves that. And the camera can usually only see that best in stillness.
You talk about the camera in this same section being Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
You remind me of this story that Mike Nichols used to tell about Elizabeth Taylor when they were doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? He said, she's not doing anything. And Burton says, trust me, it'll be 25% different in the bath. And he, after the first time he saw rushes, he went, oh. And did you learn how to watch movie acting from doing that same, like actually watching the rushes? And
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean,
the dailies, we should say. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. I remember actually that that's another Denzel story. I'm doing a bunch of those today. But Freddie Fields, who was a vet producer. And when I first saw the first day of Denzel in Glory, Freddie Fields looked up at the screen. He said, Jesus Christ, the kid carries his own lights. that's in a scene with Morgan Freeman and Andre Brower. And, you know, that was, you know, that was revelatory.
Is it tough to read these anecdotes and not relive the kind of the cost of what it took to go through these things? I mean, reading the stuff about Shakespeare in Love,
uh-huh.
and dealing with Harvey,
yeah.
and then having to deal with the stuff after that with
yeah.
trying to get your movie star. I mean, each of these feels like a body blow to me.
I'm from Chicago. and I don't know. No, I know. That sounds silly. But there is something that is... It's going to sound self-serving to talk about the struggle, because we're given an extraordinary set of opportunities, and it is beyond a blessing to be able to do these kinds of things. On the other hand, you just have to put on the plastic suit and sweat and go up the steps. And you know, I don't know. I can't describe it any better. It's just what you do. It's grit. I think I love that. I think some part of me wants to be in that moment of real extremis.
Well, my guess who's showing us the Chicago way is author Ed Zwick, writing about the film experiences of writer-director Edward Zwick. The book is Hits, Flops, and Other Illusions. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Ed. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Edward Zwick, the writer-director of film and TV, is the same person as Ed Zwick, the author of the readable new book, Hits, Flops, and Illusions, My 40-something Years in Hollywood. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. With The Treat, Grant Singer, director and co-writer of his feature film debut, Reptile, about an authority figure we think we understand. He offers a new take on a long-enduring classic about a detective we also thought we got.
Hi, I'm Grant Singer, and this is The Treat. The film that changed my life is a film called Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock. This film, to me, is about the recreation of trauma to overcome one's past. Famously, people talk about it being about obsession, which certainly it is. But, you know, I've heard Scorsese talk about this film, specifically about the serenity of the movie. The sequences where Jimmy Stewart is following Kim Novak through the streets of San Francisco, there's something so meditative about those scenes. And certainly, I think it lives in a genre of its own. I remember the first 5-10 times I watched Vertigo, there'd be scenes I'm like, huh, that's in the movie? I was completely hypnotized by the filmmaking that I forgot what it is that I was seeing. It's one of the few films that's done that for me. Bernard Herrmann's score for Vertigo is my favorite film score of all time. The film seduces you, the film music seduces you, and they're very much in dialogue with one another. And if you watch the movie, you'll notice that the music dips out for many moments, sometimes 5, 6, 7 moments, but then when it comes back in, it's just, it adds this depth to the feeling. This is one moment where Midge asks Jimmy Stewart's character, so what are you doing? And at this point in the story, we're very aware of what he's been doing. He's been following Kim Novak's character and falling in love with her, and it's so deep, it's so profound. And he just says, wandering, and he just throws the line away, and the delivery of that line is so masterful. It's so comedic, it's so dramatic, it's so poignant, it's brilliant.
For a man who has nothing to do, you're certainly a... busy little bee. Where do you go these days?
Just wandering.
Where?
Roundabout.
Oh.
In this film in particular, even when I'm aware of what the Kim Novak character is doing, there's still moments where I'm like, is she acting? Or is she really her at this moment? Or is she falling in love with him? Or is this a seduction? It's not. I'm constantly questioning the motives and how Hitchcock was directing these people.
I'm scared. I'm not mad. I don't want to die. There's someone within me, and she says I must die. Oh, Scotty, don't let me go.
I'm here. I've got you.
I'm so afraid.
Every time I rewatch it, I realize I'm always asking myself, why is this my favorite film? Why am I so drawn to this? And I have to say, I do think part of it, being from California and seeing it at a time before I was born, it's accessing this thing that a life outside my own, but then also the performances. To me, it's if film is a magic trick, this is the most beautiful and eloquent one that I've seen.
Grant Singer's first feature film as writer-director was Reptile, his treat, his perspective on Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. Here, past treats, such as the creators of the Showtime series Billions, on a film classic that taught them a thing or two about criminal behavior and how long they could go without a meal at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreat. Iconic episodes that create a fascination with the world of creativity. Revisited by creators from almost every endeavor. That's The Treat. And that's our show. Produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Yes, we had help from Laura Kondarajan and Phil Richards. To better days, y'all. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.